This is Fuel.
Fuel for thought.
Jet fuel.
Fuel injected.
Fuel for your business.
Welcome to The Fuel, the new business podcast, and I'm your host, Keith Smith. Fuel is brought to you in association with The Advertist, the UK's only independent business development platform for creative, marketing and digital agencies. You can find The Advertist at www.theadvertist.com or call 0203 356 3717. When we received the news that the last show helped us get to nearly 1,000 listens, we got a bit giddy and broke out the slur. Our smiles only got bigger when we heard from the funniest man on LinkedIn, Jeremy Davis, who sent us this message.
They say that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again in the expectation of a different result. In that respect, you could say the new business people are a bunch of total nut jobs. Because no matter what you may read on LinkedIn, from influential opinion formers convinced that they've discovered the silver bullet, a guaranteed foolproof technique that works every time, there's no denying that new business can be a repetitive job. It's 98% perspiration, and a lot of that sweat will be spilled on arduous and monotonous prospecting campaigns that finish right back where you started from. I spoke a while back about how difficult it can be for a new business person to describe what he or she does over a dinner party conversation, but I did once hit on quite a good metaphor, which, appropriately enough, was conceived in the offices of a swanky Bristol advertising agency. Waiting to board my train at Paddington on the way to my first meeting with my new client, I noticed a fish tank in the corner of the coffee lounge in which a plucky-looking little fish was determinedly swimming downwards towards the filter, from which rose a steady stream of bubbles. Every time he got close to the source of these bubbles, he would shoot back up to the top and begin the whole process again. Whether he was hoodwinked by the famously short memory for which fish are known, or simply possessed of a determination which made Nemo's dad appear a quitter, I saw in him the sort of stubborn optimism and unquestioning faith that exemplifies a good new business person even when things aren't going well. When the bosses of that agency asked me to describe my approach, I told them the story of my fishy friend. I might not have got away with it in the offices of a firm of accountants or lawyers, but the advertising execs gobbled it up like so much fish food. This was before the publication of the seminal marketing book Eating the Big Fish, fortunately. Otherwise, we could have ended up with some seriously mixed metaphors. But I'm pleased to report that it was the start of a mutually beneficial partnership, which yielded at least one lucrative new account, a win which began with a chance conversation on a train. But that's a story for another day. What I want you to take away from today, though, is that if you're a new business person going through a dry spell, don't lose faith. There's always plenty more fish in the tank.
I think that's really important. I think that's the one thing that we should definitely hold on to, is that we can control our own life through the choices that we make. Because they are the choices. They are choices. They're not, you know, you're lucky to be an artist. It's like, if you want to be an artist, pick up a paintbrush, pick up a pen, and just have a go. You might surprise yourself, or you might not. And if you don't, maybe go buy some yeast and try and make some bread.
Deep in the heart of South London lives a man whose artistic expressions are about the hippest thing you could align your agency, brand, or product with. Vic Lee has been a target of mine since we kicked this show off. I love his work. He's a muralist, an illustrator, and his work is cherished by creatives, and frankly, you can't get any hipper than Vic. I managed to grab an hour of his time while he was catching his breath between shifts of sending out his collector's item of a book, The Corona Diary 2020, a view of the pandemic from his perspective, which is satirical, amusing, quirky, and poignant. So let's just get on with it, shall we? Here's me and Vic Lee for your listening pleasure. Inspiration's a wonderful thing. Nearly everyone needs it, and only a few know how to make it happen. Me, I tend to rely on luck. If I'm trying to do something and an event happens or a thought strikes me, then I consider it divine providence. And that's how I got to speak to my next guest, Vic Lee. If you don't know the name, you've probably seen his work. Vic is one of this century's coolest artists, muralists, and storytellers. Based out of his studio in South London, Vic's distinctive black and white artwork, although he has been known to work in colour, has attracted the likes of Brompton Bicycles, the famous Grouse. His murals have been commissioned by Virgin Atlantic, Credit Karma, Aviva, Nike, and a fistful of hip creative agencies such as Bulletproof, Initials Marketing, Shine PR, Havas, and Freestone Creative, to name a few. He's been featured at the Tate Modern, and he's even got imitators, which is surely a sign you've made it. And my lucky day came when I was working on a show about creativity and what inspires creative people to be creative. When I was diving into LinkedIn, I saw a lanky artist throwing down some very cool Northern Soul moves to music playing in his studio, and I just had to speak to him. I reached out to him, he blanked me. I reached out again, and nothing. On the third attempt, I got the warmest of emails back from him with a firm yes to an interview. I know now why he was so hard to get hold of, because not only is he working flat out for demanding agencies, but he's also in the middle of launching a book called The Corona Diaries 2020. Fortunately, the post office is closed today, so he's unable to send out any more copies until tomorrow. So without further ado, let's welcome the artist currently known as Vic Lee. Welcome, Vic.
Hello, mate. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for taking the time to speak to me, especially when you're acting like a one-man Amazon warehouse sending out editions of your new book. So I hope all is well in your neck of the woods, and you have family with you.
Yeah. It's all good, mate. It's all good. We've had a good time. I will actually go back to the first thing you said about lanky. Maybe that was just the angle of the camera, I'll be honest with you. But lanky, I ain't, I tell you. I'll definitely be recording stuff from that angle again.
Very flattering, yeah, obviously. Yeah. But you're in South London, I take it, aren't you? Peckham.
Yeah. I'm in Peckham. So the heart of South London.
Beautiful.
Some people would disagree with that, but I think it's true.
Well, I used to live near there in Bermondsey and then Forest Hill. I know Peckham very well. I've got a photograph on my wall of my dad's first car taken outside Peckham Rye Park. So I know it fairly well.
Nice. Yeah. It's a great place. It's a great place to live. It's a good community here and nice bunch of people. And I mean, where we are, it feels like we're in the countryside. I think we're just surrounded by trees in the back garden. So it means a lot at this moment in time.
I was going to say, it's good for the peace of mind, isn't it? Just to hear the birds tweeting and stuff when you're in lockdown.
But, yeah, definitely.
So anyway, I want to get onto your book in a few minutes, but I'm hoping that before we start, you could give us a bit of a background. Because you're an unusual beast for this podcast, and you're the first kind of real artist that we've interviewed. So I just wanted to come at it from a different sort of perspective. I mean, how did you get into being an artist? I mean, you know, what brought you here?
It's a long journey, I'll be honest with you. I wasn't one of those amazing artists that went to Slade School of Art and then came out and did some amazing oil paintings and took over the world. I left school when I was, I guess, 16. I won't go all the way back because it'll take forever. just to give you a feedback, a little bit of insight. So I left school when I was 16. I was a postman, restored billiard tables, painter and decorator. I worked on a cruise ship for 3 years. And then at 28, I decided to go to university and study graphic design. And I think that was I kind of realized that I needed to make money and I didn't know what to do. And obviously back then, this is like 20 odd years ago, graphic design was the thing to do. So went into graphics and did that for about 15, 16 years, maybe.
Wow. Okay.
And then I not got bored with it, but I realized I didn't want to, I think I got to an age where I thought, I don't want to be a 50-year-old graphic designer going into a studio and listening to all these young, hip 20-year-olds talking about bands I'd never heard of and phrases I had no idea what they meant. So I need to get out. And I didn't, yeah, and that's when I started illustrating again, basically.
Wow. So, I mean, it may sound like a dumb question. I'm not sure. Probably most of my questions are dumb anyway. But were you like into comics and stuff when you were a kid? And
yeah, definitely. I mean, I've still got, so I used to read 2000 AD from the first issue and battle action as well. And I've still got a big collection of 2000 ADs that I've kept for, you know, many, many years. So I've always loved comic strip art.
Right.
But not up to the point where I'm like an avid collector. Right. That was just kind of growing up. And then I started illustrating all through school. I was one of those ginger kids. I was a ginger kid with national health specs. I was lanky back then. So I was kind of bullied at school. So I think my escape was through illustration, but also my slightly warped sense of humour as well, which helped.
Fantastic. Well, I was going to ask you if your education had a big impact on your abilities, but clearly it kind of it sort of influenced it from a different direction. And I didn't realize you come at it so, you know, sort of fairly late in life. I mean, that's for most people. So it's good to hear and encouraging for lots of people who've got the ambition and have never really tried to apply themselves. Now, onto the kind of commercial sort of side of things. I mean, do you consider yourself to be a sort of a commercial beast or an artistic beast first? What's how does that work?
That's a good one. So it took me, I think when I first started, I probably would have said I was an illustrator.
Right.
Because I was doing quite a lot of illustrative stuff. So I started off doing Streets of London. That's kind of how everything kicked off for me. So I was drawing Streets of London and like Lordship Lane where I lived in East Dulwich, and then going up to Columbia Road, Broadway Market, going all over London, and then screen printing. And then these ended up being sold all over the world.
Right.
I remember doing my very first print that I did was Lordship Lane. I was still a graphic designer, so I was still working full time. And I did an illustration of the local area with all the businesses on and did history, and I screen printed it and I stuck it on a local forum. Thinking, you know, if I sell 10 of these, that's amazing. As soon as I put it on the forum, my email was just going off. Like it was literally every 2 or 3 minutes. So all these orders were coming in. So for about, I'd probably say about 3 weeks after, I didn't realize there was a thing called the post office back then. So I used to put all these rolled up prints in the back of my little Renault Clio, drive around East Dulwich, Camberwell and Peckham, and hand deliver all these prints to people. And then they would give me, I think they were 35 quid back then. So they would then give me 35 quid cash. And then I'd stick the money in my glove box of the Clio. So for 3 weeks, it was almost like my glove box was full of cash. And I laugh because it was maybe, you know, you talk about having a lot of dealers in South London, but I was maybe the first art dealer in South London. Do you know what I mean? So, that's how it all kicked off.
And you probably doubled the value of that Clio as well while doing that.
I'm not sure about that. I think I wore it out, mate.
So, I mean, that answered the next question, which is like, you know, so you'd be doing this kind of work unpaid anyway. I mean, this is just an outlet for you, is it?
Yeah, I mean, to a degree. I mean, when I first started, it was my personal, it was a personal sort of, adventure. So I was still working as a graphic designer. But then because the prints started selling, all over the world, it was crazy. I think I got featured on a US website, and then that just blew up as well.
Amazing. And then
eventually I just thought, let's just go for it. Let's just, you know, let's call graphics a day and let's just go illustration all the way. And that's how it all kicked off. Basically, it just taking that initial step away from the safety zone.
Yeah.
Something that I had no idea how I was going to make enough money or, you know, be sustainable and stuff. But it seems to have worked for 10 years, so I'm not complaining.
Well, this is that's a very interesting point, because it's I remember a famous quote from David Bowie, who I sort of followed in my formative years, and he was talking about being creative, and he said that the art of being creative was to, when you go into the water, is just to get yourself slightly out of your depth where your feet don't touch the ground, they stop touching the bottom, so that puts you in a danger zone, and that kind of tends to inspire you to be a little bit more creative, I think. But
sink or swim, isn't it?
It is absolutely. So I mean, you work with, I mean, you just got to look at your website. I mean, look at all the hip agencies that you're working with, that you have worked for and with. But and I'm sure you still get lots of requests from like the Hoxton agency set all the time. But I mean, how do you vet them? I mean, you know, do you look at the agency and think, you know, is there ever a judgment, or is it just a pure, you know, you'll take whatever comes your way?
No. It's got nothing to do with who the agency is. It's got nothing to do with where they are.
Right.
I'm not as snobby as that, to be honest. I get huge amounts. I would. On an average, before COVID hit,
yeah,
I would probably get between maybe 5 to 15 inquiries a week from people. Yeah, crazy. I mean, about 160 inquiries a year just from people seeing my work. So I would send quotes off, and most of the time I'd not hear anything back. And you get hardened to that to a degree,
yeah.
But it still annoys you as well at the same time. But it's the people that respond and the people that go, look, yeah, you're quite fine. And for me, they're the ones that I want to work for, because they fully understand the amount
process,
of work.
Yeah,
but also the fact that this is, I think what I do, especially doing mural work, is unique. I don't know anyone who does anything like I do, because most of the, I'd probably say 90% of the murals are made up on the spot.
Right.
So my clients never know what they're going to get. I mean, it's crazy if you think about that.
Oh,
you
know? Okay. Well, don't blow this, because I've got more questions along these lines. So one thing I was actually going to say, I was watching a couple of videos and stuff of your work, and it kind of strikes me. I mean, you know, a lot of people, you know, especially me, if I'm ever sketching and stuff like that, I hate people looking at the stuff that I do. But I mean, with you, you kind of turned it into a bit of a kind of a performance art, really. I mean, you know, you in the mural work, especially that you're doing, you must have people standing around you all the time, you know, sort of, you know, just go, well, what's that then? And who's this for? And what do you mean by that? Do you have to put up with people as a byproduct of what you're doing, don't you? You have to put up with
spectators. I love that, though. I mean, I always say to my client, look, whoever the client is, I always say, look, if you can do this as a live thing in a live office, that's
okay. For me,
that's better, because I love, I mean, I'm so used to it. I'm so used to working in a live environment. I normally have this process. So I'll go in. Most of the time, the staff have no idea what I'm doing.
Right.
So I'll go in, I'll have this massive white wall, which will all be agreed. We'll agree a design and the words. And then I'll start. So I'll rock up with all my equipment as people are walking past me. And I have this thing. So it's normally Monday. If I start on a Monday, finish on a sort of Friday. So I start on a Monday. Monday people come in. They look at me like I'm an idiot, thinking, why is this idiot drawing all over our walls? Tuesday, they might slowly walk past because they can see it taking shape. Wednesday, they'll stop. And look, Thursday they'll start talking to me and basically sharing their life story, and then Friday they'll probably want to pick up a pen and start painting themselves, you know. So it's really, I've had so many amazing conversations with people midway through the week about I remember this one guy in America, he was a contractor for one of the jobs,
yeah.
And he kept walking past as I started the job. And then by middle of it, he stopped. And then the day after, he came over to me and he told me his life story about, you know, his brother and being an architect. I think he was from South America, but he was living in the States.
Yeah.
And he hadn't seen his brother for about 30 years. His brother left home when he was younger. And he hadn't seen him, but his brother still lived in Brazil, I think. And he found out that his brother died. But during when the funeral was happening, this guy was trying to get his green card, and the government, US government, said, if you leave now to go to your brother's funeral, you won't get your card. So he's, and he told me this entire story because his brother was an architect in Brazil. And he said, I hadn't seen my brothers for 30 years, and then I couldn't even go to his funeral to say goodbye because I would have lost my green card working in the States. And I get a lot of these little stories, and they, if my art can bring that out and make people remember certain things, then for me, that's, it's amazing. And to be able to listen and share a story, I love that. I think that people are amazing. You just got to stop and talk to them now and again. You know what I mean?
Wow, that's a great story. That's fantastic. And yeah, I mean, you know, it is a it's a bonding thing. I think when people see somebody working, you know, who's clearly got a gift, it's always, you know, it's fascinating to, you know, to watch. And but you, now, in terms of qualifications, I just want to touch on them briefly. You're a member of the International Society of Typographic Designers. And
yes,
the Association of Illustrators. But and a lot of your work also, or a lot of your work basically involves some fabulous typography. Now, I've got two questions on this.
Yes.
When you work with companies to produce the murals, how do you go about choosing the words that you use? And then what is the power of those words?
Okay, that's a good one. So whenever, if I meet a client, I think I've got to this stage where maybe there's a confidence thing, but I think there's also, for me, it's all about honesty.
Right.
So if I meet a client, it doesn't matter if it's, you know, a blue chip or it's, you know, Fortune 500 or, you know, a small, much smaller client. I'll always sit down with them, or, well, if it's a way, well, kind of have a meeting over the phone. And they'll always ask, what do you want from us? And I'll say, just send me all of your marketing stuff, who you are and what you do and everything. And I, maybe it's a cheek because I'm from London, I don't know, but I'll always say, you know, because it's really, I say, look, I'll reword it because it's going to be really boring what you're going to send me. you know, there is a little bit of confidence there, but it's honesty. And more, you know, 99% of the time, they'll be shocked, but then they'll nod their heads and go, yeah, it is a little bit. So I'll take their words or their philosophy, and then I'll reword it in a, I guess what I would call a cheeky sort of Victorian charm way. So it says the same thing, but it says it in much more poetic language.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean.
Very much so. Yeah.
Don't ask me to give you any ideas or quotes because I won't be able to think of any of them.
Well, because it's funny you say that, because a lot of your work sort of visually kind of harkens back to the old kind of Victorian billboards and, that kind of era of the, really the kind of birth of typography as well, where, you know, everybody just plastered loads of different typefaces everywhere just to, because it looked great, you know.
Yeah. I did a talk in Germany. A friend of mine, Mark, he runs a conference over there called Beyond Telleran. So I was asked to do a talk on my work. And obviously I use just bucket loads of fonts and typography. Mm-hmm. You know, if I'm breaking from the norm of traditional graphic design, you know, we were told never use more than 3 fonts in any piece. So, you know, I've blown that right out of the water. But yeah, I was following this really lovely lady who was a web, I think she was a web developer come designer. And so she was on stage. She was talking about, yeah, whatever you do in websites, don't use more than sort of 3 fonts because it becomes chaotic and unreadable, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, big round of applause. And she came off. And then I came on stage. And I was like, look at this. I've used 500 fonts in one piece. And that looks. And yeah, it was kind of funny because that's, I think it shouldn't work, but it does. Mm. I don't know why, but it seems to play with people's I guess what I like to say is the work that I create is black and white. It's very traditional, but with a contemporary twist. And it's of a lifetime that we think we've had, but we've never lived through.
Right.
So we associate with, like you said, you know, the old Victorian, you know, you don't look that old to me. You don't look like a Victorian type of baby to me, Keith, I'll be honest with you.
I used to have some mutton chops and a big long tash, you know. I looked like a carnival barker at one stage. But so, I mean, the power of words is phenomenal. I mean, you must believe in that. I mean, given the way that your work goes, the way it presents itself. I mean, it's very, very word driven. You must have a real belief in the power of the single word or a phrase just to sort of drive people's emotions.
Yeah, completely. I mean, I think the one thing that I was fascinated with typography, just coming from a graphic design background, but also afterwards when I started becoming an illustrator and artist, was we see words everywhere we look. I'm looking at you on screen, and I'm looking at words everywhere, all over the script. Everywhere I look, there's words. Yep. So we take typography and words for granted because they're everywhere. So what I wanted to do was almost give them their own personality. So you stop, you look, and you appreciate not only the words, but the form of each letter as well. Because I think without them, we'd be lost, you know? So words and type are so important. And never forget that. So when you look at something, maybe you have a think about, it's like everything in life, isn't it? You should stop and think about everything you look at now and again to appreciate it to a degree.
It's very powerful stuff, very powerful stuff. And I mean, okay, well, leading into the book now, which, give it another plug, it's the Corona Diaries 2020, right?
Corona Diary 2020.
Okay. Now, yep. Is this your first book?
Yes.
Right.
I actually started on a portfolio book last year.
Right.
And then that's been left behind a little bit. I'll work on that over the next sort of 6 months. But yeah, Corona Diary is my first accidental book.
And what's obviously the virus itself as a form of inspiration, but what led you to think, okay, well, I can turn this into a coffee table book?
I'd say the power of social media is amazing.
All right.
My followers basically, were the ones who, inspired me, I suppose. I mean, when this Corona malarkey started. So me and my partner had just come back from Malaysia and Singapore. We got back on New Year's Eve.
Yep.
And then, so we were getting back into London and obviously hating everything about it, as you do. And then this thing kicked off, and we didn't really know what was going on. I've spoken to a lot of my male friends and my female friends, and I think the male friends have definitely taken this much more badly than the female ones.
Right.
I think women generally look at stuff and get on with it. They go, oh crap, it's a virus. Right, let's protect everything. Let's go shopping. Let's do all the things we need to do. And now let's get on with it. Whereas men go, oh crap, we're all going to die. End of the world. Stock up, fill the basement, lock the doors, don't talk to anyone. And I'm going to be on the news 24/7.
Yeah,
there's almost this panic that started, and I felt like that. So I started illustrating this diary just for my own peace of mind, I guess, just to
an outlet.
Yeah, to understand it and to write down what was happening. And I put a little flick through up on little video up on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
And I shared that, and I thought, you know, normally I'll get a few hundred likes, and that was it. And it sort of escalated. So I think the latest, last time I looked, which was about a month ago, it had like 250,000 views, like 12,000 likes, and like 1,200 comments. But everyone was saying, you have to publish this, which I wasn't going to. It was a really just a personal journal. And that's how it came about, basically. purely by accident.
Is it self-published, or I mean, have you got a publisher behind it?
No, I'm doing. I'm sort of cutting out the middleman. I'm cutting out the middleman, the end man, and the guy just after the start man as well.
That sounds like a canny strategy there.
Yes, I mean, it's, if you start a house, you probably wouldn't say that because it's stacked guy high. And my missus is definitely getting a bit pissed off with boxing up loads of books at the moment. But she's doing all right. She's on a minimum wage, obviously.
Well, fair enough then.
Yeah, exactly. No, she's not. She's well looked after before any of your... she's not looked after.
Fearing a social media backlash, very, very quick to correct himself.
She's an absolute star, and without her, I would be lost.
No,
for sure.
Exactly.
I am nothing without her.
Yeah.
But yeah, self-published.
Good.
I dropped a book off to someone local today, and I was having a chat to him, and I said, when I started going through this, I did a pre-order page, and I thought, well, let's just see how many pre-orders I get, and then I can, once I finish the diary, which was the 1st of June, then I can maybe put the order in to the publishers, the printers. So I thought I might get 100 orders if I'm lucky. And it just blew up. It just went mad. So I think I sold about 1,300 books even before it was published. So that was just crazy. And it made me really happy because everyone else was being so supportive. And I think that's the thing, that, especially during this situation, COVID-19 situation, I think having people, strangers, complete strangers, support you and make you feel positive about something you're doing, and that they can then buy into is amazing.
Well, I guess in a weird kind of way, it's almost giving back to you what you give to people through your artwork on murals and stuff like that. Is that, you know, it's a way of people being able to have the same effect on you that you have on them through your work. So thoroughly justified, I would say. But I mean, obviously, there isn't a target market for this book. This is just something that you've put out there, and all sorts of people have gone
mad.
Yeah. So it's not really aimed at any specific demographic. It's just anybody that's very dischuffed with the whole virus thing.
Yeah. Well, I think my main target, audience is who's been affected by Corona. Hang on a minute. That's the entire planet. Right.
Well, okay. Well, switching gears slightly, talking about, I want to just touch lightly on podcasts as well. I mean, up until I contacted you, I mean, do you listen to podcasts at all? Are you into it?
I'll be honest with you, I don't. I do every now and again, but I mainly listen to music. I'm really into music. It's my way of switching off from news, but also I guess listening to other people talk. That sounds really bad doing this, because now everyone's gonna we can switch off and go, oh, he's banging on about nothing again. So I think because I read a lot of news, I read a lot of books,
right.
So I read every day, so I'm really hyper informed of a lot of stuff,
right.
Whether it's or factual, but I think music for me is really important to switch off when I'm when I'm working.
Well,
but
clearly,
I listen to your podcast from here on in, Keith. That's for sure.
Well, that will at least double our listenership, so it'll be fantastic. Well, I mean, the reason I asked about the podcast was that obviously, you know, technology has kind of made you and your artwork kind of a lot more accessible, and everybody now has a window on your work, and indeed in your studio now. I mean,
yes.
I mean, have you ever thought of, you know, do you have any ambitions to get into the kind of more into the video and the sort of video vlogging areas at all? Or is that not something you have any preference towards?
No, I think there's so many people doing some amazing stuff out there. And I mean, I'm a one man band, but my girlfriend laughs at me. She's just like, you do everything. You do everything. And I'm like, yeah, I kind of do. If I do a mural, not only do I plan it and I do all the, you know, meet the client and do basically what a design agency does.
Right.
But then I film it and then I edit it and then I make the music. And then it's almost like I have this, I think I've got this uncontrollable urge to do everything. We had a friend around earlier who's coming around to buy a book, and we were just having some scones and tea in the garden.
How civilized.
Yeah, how lovely. My lass cooked the scones and they were very good. But she said, I don't know, I said something, and my our friend Annie said, she said, oh, that sounds like a song. And my girlfriend Helen, she said, God, she said, you know, it's the only thing you can't do. She said, you can do everything else, but, you know, everyone's going, oh, haven't you brought out a record yet, Vic? And it's and it was like, no, I said, I'm not. When I get to 60, I'll probably bring out, you know, a number one album. But until then, yeah.
Well, at least you could, I was going to say, you could find plenty of recording artists who'd have you do the covers for the artwork for all their music, you know.
Yeah.
But, I mean, interesting question came up recently on, you mentioned LinkedIn, when there was quite a bit of a highbrow conversation going on about people and their right to call themselves experts, you know, in various things. And obviously from our field of marketing, and the objection was that you shouldn't really be able to call yourself an expert unless you actually had the qualifications to back it up. I mean, how do you feel about that?
That's a good question. I mean, if you kind of said, do I have the qualifications to back up being an artist and illustrator? I haven't, because I have got no qualifications in art and illustration, just graphic design. So I think to be an expert in your field, It's a grey area, because I think I wouldn't say I'm an expert in my field, because I don't know what an expert is. But I'd say if I'm admired enough and I'm busy enough, then I'd say I have expertise in what I do. But I'm not an expert in my field, because there's not really many other people that can do what I do, so there's nothing else to compare it to.
Right.
So I guess maybe if you're an expert, you need to be able to compare it to what somebody else is doing to a degree. Otherwise, you've got nothing to base it on. You know, I could say, well, I'm going to draw around plug sockets for the rest of my life. And people are like, yeah, okay, that's not a job. And it's like, I'm an expert in it. because nobody else does it. And you think, well, there's nothing else to compare it to, is there? So, I don't know. I'd say there's a 10-year thing, isn't there? It's supposed to be you have to spend 10,000 hours doing one thing to be an expert in it. But you could spend 10,000 hours doing the same thing and still be crap. Do you know what I mean? So who's to tell, really?
That's fantastic. I love it. But with regards to the nature of creativity, I did a podcast recently called Never Mind the Bullshit, which examined the roots of creativity and what actually inspires creative people in the advertising and marketing industry.
Yeah.
And we looked at how ideas are formed, and I wanted to see if you had any examples or ideas based on the kind of five subjects that we covered. And the first of the subjects in terms of what makes people creative was the ability to juxtapose ideas. You know, to use juxtaposition. So, you know, and to me, the Corona Diary is a fantastic juxtaposition of sorts, given that it's something kind of quite beautiful in a world of ugliness. So it's something that's inspired by disaster. I mean, do you think that juxtaposition is a good sort of route for creativity?
Yeah, I think so. I think maybe the way that we see things can be quite it can be quite narrow-minded at times, especially creatively. We working as a graphic designer, I found that a lot of the times we'd come up with some crazy good ideas, but they would then be stifled either by the accounts because they didn't want to upset the client, or the client because they didn't want to put their job at risk.
Right.
So I think there's definitely, I think for me, fear is one of our biggest enemies. And once you can look fear in the eye and deal with it, I think maybe you can create some amazing things. You just have to be willing to take those chances. For me, I do things off my back, and those things suddenly become something much bigger if one person sees it. The yeah. Brompton bicycle job came about because I'd drawn on a bicycle. I bought an old bicycle from Lou, and I did it up, painted it white, and then I drew all over it. And I left it outside my girlfriend's studio where she is. And the girl who was next door is married to the creative director. I think he's still there at the time of Brompton Bicycles, who saw the bike. He then said, "Would you like to draw on our bike?" And then it just escalated from there. So,
That's a great juxtaposition, isn't it? It's taking your artwork and putting it onto a folding bicycle.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, you never know where things are going to go. And I think because a lot of people are afraid of failure.
Yeah.
But the way I look at it is, if you don't do something, you failed already. If you do something and you do it badly, it just means that you've had a go at it and you're not very good at it. It doesn't mean you're a failure.
Or you can do it again.
Or you can do it again, and you can spend another 9,990 hours doing a better job. But fear of failure is one of the biggest things. And once you take that away, you suddenly see that you don't ever fail, no matter how badly things come out.
What about appropriation or stealing, as some people like to call it, or borrowing? I mean, there are plenty of examples of famous creative work that's actually, you know, later been discovered to have been rooted somewhere else. I mean, do you think that a kind of all creative work is kind of based on other stuff that's gone before it, or, you know, is it hard to find something that's absolutely truly original?
Yeah, I mean, it's getting to the point now where, you know, everyone says that it's all been done before, so you mm-hmm. can't really do something, you know, original anymore. I like to think that I'm probably the exception to that rule, and I think maybe that's where you sort of go, "Oh, I haven't seen that before," and you go, "Yeah, it's an amalgamation of something else, but it's just done in a slightly different way." And maybe that's where we are, is that we're taking ideas. When the corona thingy-majiggy was on, full flow, somebody posted this video and said, in advertising, how lazy advertisers are. And there were all these series of ads. This was based in America, but if you look in the UK, it's the same thing. So they took about maybe 30 or 40 adverts filmed in the US, and they split them up into the beginning, the middle, the second part of the middle, and then the end.
Right.
And they were all identical. Because it was corona, because it was COVID, they said, first bit, music, solemn, sad-looking people. Middle bit, slightly heartwarming, let's talk about the family. End bit, uplifting music, everyone looks happy, and let's talk about the future. And you, honestly, if you look at any advert that's come out in the UK, you go, "Oh my God, we're doing it here as well."
Yeah.
It's almost like this really, I'm going to say, quite boring, you know, attitude.
Derivative, yeah.
It's almost like repeating what somebody else has done.
Yeah. I was going to say, it's almost like you need a coronavirus advert generator, you know, where you could just put, you know, select different things, and it'll just create your advert for you at the end of it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I've got the Corona app, so I've just done an app for you. All
right. Fantastic. Now, okay, another example of where creativity comes from is context. You know, so is a piece of creative work actually creative unless it addresses something? And I think the example that that I wanted to use was like, you know, sort of the fellow that invented the shipping container, which, you know, was a fantastic idea, which laid fallow for a couple of, or a decade at least, but until the Vietnam War came along and the US Army needed to ship large amounts of equipment across the huge oceans. And that then everybody was like, wow, what a fantastic solution that is. I mean, do you think that the context is important, or is integral to creativity?
Yeah, I think so. I think if you've got something to say, I think it's really important. I think the whole point is to make people stop and think, whether that's in any sort of creativity, whether that's making music or furniture or print or anything. I think if you can make people stop and think, and maybe look at the bigger picture. For me, that's really important. I don't want to create stuff that is namby-pamby. And I know, like you said, like, you know, it's just cutting out the bullshit, isn't it? It's actually being honest and saying, look, I want to give you a message. How you take that message is entirely up to you. You know, Jack might read the message and be completely different to Jill's understanding of the message. But fundamentally, it's the same thing, but it's how we understand it. And I think if you can go away, especially in this day and age where, you know, the environment's a bit knackered, shall we say, nobody gives a damn about global warming. The whole, I think one of the things about this, I say no one gives a damn, everyone gives a damn, apart from people who need to give a damn, basically.
Who matter, yes.
Yeah. So, but with this book, with the Corona Diary that I started, I'm trying to make it not political, but I do have a view in it, which you can tell once you read it. But I don't want to get into that sort of, you know, the dirty logistics of it, but I just want to point out a few facts. And I want people to look at the diary, read it, and sort of remember bits that happened through our daily lives, but also for certain people to be accountable for their actions during this time, as opposed to going, oh, we said that, but we didn't mean that. But then you think, hang on a second, why are we always letting the, I guess, the people that we look up to in government, and this is across the world, why do we just accept that that's the way it is and let them get away with it? Why aren't they accountable for their actions like we are when we're at work? If we do something wrong, we're fired or we're reprimanded or suspended. They do something wrong, they just say, get over it. And you just think, oh, man, this is bullshit. So there is a little bit of that in there.
Yes.
So yeah, creativity is important to make people think, but it's also good to make people not think and to be able to switch off from reality as well.
Okay. Now, in terms of your own behavior, you know, so, I mean, a lot of people in the creative business go, well, you know, the idea just came to me. But what we discovered when we were doing the podcast was that more often than not, that these people are actually doing something when that idea came to them. They're actually, it's kind of almost like an unconscious habit that they formed. In order to be able to sort of make the, you know, get the creative juices flowing. And sometimes it's even just not thinking about it. I mean, do you have any kind of warm-up exercises? I mean, do you like switch off or go for a walk or, you know, take a bath, whatever?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, my partner, Helen, she'll always say, let's go for a walk, and I'll always get a bit grouchy. I don't want to go for a walk. And then I go for a walk and I go, well, that was a really nice walk, wasn't it? And she's right. Like, you're a dick. And I need her to sort of tell me what I need to do, because I don't necessarily think of it as at the right time. So she's good for me to get me out of my comfort zone and take me away from my safety as well. Uh-huh. I think I definitely have this. It's like if we go on holiday, I'll have packed a week in advance. She'll pack an hour before, and then I'll get stressed because she hasn't packed. And then we'll have an argument, and she'll be at one end of the train, and I'll be at the other end of the train, and then we'll meet up and have a great holiday. So, you know, at least we're consistent in that respect.
So she kind of helps drive helps create the conditions that allow you to do the thing that, you know, you do best, basically. I mean, is that what you're saying?
Yeah. So I think for me, I'm a workhorse.
You might overthink it.
Well, no, I don't overthink. That's the thing. I think I've got one of these brains that compartmentalizes really well.
Okay.
So I was taught from an early, I think we're probably around the same sort of age, 25, 30. So when I was growing up, my dad, my old man, my mum passed away from cancer when I was younger, when I was three. So my dad, who was an immigrant from Malta, he raised me and my sister. And he taught us the value of hard work, but also living as well. So we used to darn our socks, darn our shirts. I learned how to sew when I was 11. I learned how to cook. I could build stuff in the shed. So yeah, that's all learning process for me. So now, you know, I pretty much build walls, plaster. I do all the housework. Uh-huh. Plumbing, electrics, to a degree. So for me, it's important for me to know, to understand what my abilities are, because I think this is going back to that failure thing, which is, oh, I won't try and build a wall because I've never done it before.
Right.
And you think, so what happens if you have a go at it and you're really good? It's like, you're never going to know, are you? So, you know.
Fantastic.
We don't know our capabilities.
No.
Until we actually have a go. You know, at the beginning of the coronavirus, I made a loaf of bread with some 5-year-old yeast and it was rubbish. It was like a brick. And then I spent the next 2 months trying to find yeast. And then eventually I found it and I've made some killer loaves.
There you go.
Maybe it was the beginning. Maybe I can't make bread. But it was, I know, it was, the yeast was crap.
Definitely, I think the coronavirus has allowed people to, has forced people to be a bit more inspired with things that they do.
Yes.
And again, you know, tangentially to that, is that people have been able to, you know, sit down, they've had the time to be able to think about, you know, how to do things rather than rushing headlong into projects because you've only got 20 minutes to get this done or you've only got an hour to do the gardening or whatever it happens to be. But the final aspect of the creative thing was the idea of just pure luck. You know, just something just happened, just came out of nowhere and you can't really explain it. I mean, does Manifest Destiny and Lady Luck ever sort of grace the work that you've done?
I've had this conversation with quite a few people before. I don't believe in luck. I think luck doesn't exist. I think luck is a superstition that we use when people, it's like, you know, people come up to me and go, oh, you're so lucky to do what you do. You're lucky to be able to be an artist. I'm like, no, I'm not. I've worked for the past sort of 40 years doing this, you know, it's not luck, it's flipping hard work. Wish it was luck. Oh, here's a horseshoe. You're an artist. Great. Thanks very much. No, it's not luck. It's what you want to be. It's what, you know, it's what makes you tick. You know, if I look back at my life, I started illustrating as a kid to get away from being bullied, but also having a time where I could be, calm and feel, it was almost like therapy for me, you know, from the ages of 11 till sort of 17. So I'm going back to being that child again, where I'm reteaching myself how to enjoy life again, but at my own pace. I think that's really important. I think that's the one thing that we should definitely hold on to, is that we can control our own life through the choices that we make, because they are choices. They're not, you know, you're lucky to be an artist. It's like, if you want to be an artist, pick up a paintbrush, pick up a pen and just have a go. You might surprise yourself or you might not. And if you don't, maybe go buy some yeast and try and make some bread.
There's your that's fantastic. That's a great piece of advice. Yes, but I really appreciate what you're putting the time in to answer those, because that was it's quite an interesting thing, the how to be creative side of things, because it's something that I've always kind of looked at from the outside in, and I've got to speak to some very, very creative people. I mean, yourself included. I mean, but musicians and you know, all sorts of people, and it's incredible how they all consider themselves to have worked hard in order to get to the point that, you know, nobody's actually turned around and said, well, you know, it's just something that I just happen to have a natural talent at. I think that it's one thing to have a talent, but it's another to be able to channel it and put it into, you know, to good use, and to put, you know, to actually turn it into something. I think that's the distinction.
Yeah, definitely. I think that, I mean, that's the thing really, is a lot of people do assume that if you're successful or semi-successful or you've done something, that you are you're a natural born, you know, like you said, musician. Mm. You know, and some people are natural born musicians, but it takes a long time to actually call. I'm sure it, for a musician, for a singer, it takes them a long time to say, I'm a musician or I'm a singer. Mm-hmm. It took me a long time to say I'm an artist, because I sort of associated it with, you know, going round to your aunt's house and then the next door neighbour coming in going, I'm an artist. And then you look at it and you go, right, that's a landscaper. And you think, oh, I don't want to be that artist. But I think I watched or listened to Grayson Perry doing the Wreath lectures, which is amazing. Yep. And he had the same thing. He said it took him a long time to call himself an artist. And it took me a long time. But I realised that I become an artist when people ask me to do one-off pieces of work for them, like the murals. Mm. So for me, I became an artist of a massive scale, creating one-off pieces in pen and paint. And so now I can say I'm an artist. The worst thing is when people go, what sort of artist are you? And I just go, oh, you know, those little, I paint landscapes of boats and, you know, and it, no, I don't say that.
By numbers.
Yeah.
But okay, well, look, I mean, we've covered a hell of a lot of ground here, Vic, and I just wanted to try and ease off the accelerator slightly here, and cool. Talking about your we referenced your studio and the music and stuff like that. I'm going to throw something at you now, just to see, and I'm probably not going to know what you're talking about, but I'm going to ask you to pick a Desert Island Disc. One song to play in your studio.
Oh God, jeez, thanks for that, Keith.
You're welcome.
There is one song which you know very few people have heard of, I'm sure. So you've heard of Chet Baker?
Yes.
So this is a guy called Chet Faker. With an F, Chet Faker. And you kind of think, oh, what is he, some sort of tribute band? So he's called Chet Faker, amazing singer. There's one song called Dead Body. And it's the best song. I mean, I've listened to it 1,000 times. My partner has listened to it 1,000 times. And it's one of those songs that has this beautiful guitar bit in it halfway through that you just melt. You just literally just, everything you do, you'll just stop, you'll sit down and you'll just listen to it and you'll be like, good God, that's amazing. And it's so that I always go back to that.
Lovely. So I mean, when you're not you know, most of the people that I talk to are kind of in the world of new business or business development, or they're sort of in the seat, you know, sort of locked in C-suite somewhere, and you know, a lot of people that I talk to, they say, well, you know, sort of when they want to relax, they pick up a pen or paintbrush and stuff and they start doing art. I mean, what do you do to relax? You start making business calls or something.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what I do. I do marketing campaigns. Crikey, yeah. Imagine if you had a flip side of that. That would be crazy, wouldn't it? If you were artistic and you then sort of, oh no, I sit down and do a year's accounting.
Put on a shirt and tie.
Exactly.
How do you relax? What do you switch off with?
For me, this is not a job. I mean, come on, let's not kid ourselves. I draw pictures for a living, and when I get paid for it, you know, I say to people, oh, you're so lucky to draw. And I'm like, look, at the end of the day, when I was a kid, I used to draw all over the walls, and my dad used to give me the back of his hand. I said, now I draw all over people's walls, and people pay me for it.
People give you a nice check.
Exactly. They have a nice bundle of cash in their hands. That's slightly ironic, but I draw for fun. I do a lot of DIY stuff. I build a lot. I learned to play guitar. I don't know, really. I'm always busy doing stuff, learning, reading. I read, like I said before, I read every day. Yep. I think I'm thinking about maybe in about 4 years, I've read about 160 books. And that's really important. I think if you're creative, read, because your imagination. I went to a conference once. I was doing a job for a very, very big company who were holding a conference in Vienna. So I took the piece of artwork out and then I was drawing it. But I listened to all the talks. Mm-hmm. And they were all massively high powered. There was a lady who used to be a White House. She was the spokesperson for the White House or press secretary. The head of IBM was there. It's a crazy pig. But this one lady asked a question and she said, asked the entire audience who had these amazing little iPad-y pen things. And she said, right, well, I want you to write down one thing as human beings that we have that makes us unique and is really important. So people were like, love and, honor and respect and all the usual answers, humor and, business acumen and stuff like that. And she looked at them and it was all coming up on the screen behind her. And she looked at them and she said, like, no, not one of you have put it. I mean, I was embarrassed because I didn't put it. But she said, imagination. She said, without imagination, we are nothing. And it's true. If you think about it, without imagination, I wouldn't be talking to you now over the internet because it's somebody else's imagination that came up with that. So everything, the glass that I'm drinking out of, the laptop I use, the seat I'm sitting on, these are all people's imagination. And without that, we're nothing. So the one thing we have that no other species has, which is the most important thing, is our imagination. And that's why I read, because it just, my imagination is taken somewhere else.
Profound, Vic. Very profound. And it actually circles back onto, sort of what you said earlier about, sort of being present in the moment and sort of appreciating the things around you. So, well, look, you have the Corona Diary 2020 shipping now. You have any other big projects in the go in the not too distant future? Have you got anything sort of once the fog lifts?
Once the fog lifts, I've got a project we're just in talks at the moment. There's actually two. There's one in the US, and then there's one in London. So one's going to be a mural in London, okay. And the other one is. I can't give too much away.
Okay.
So that's quite nice just to have those. Cause I just, this whole period, I realized that my work situation was going to be completely dead. And I thought it might be like that for about 2 or 3 years. Well, not 2 years, for about 6 months to a year. Mm-hmm. So it's quite nice for it to sort of slowly take shape. But this project, I mean, seriously, Keith, if you've got like a spare couple of days, mate, you can come around and pack up some books for me. It's ridiculous. When you've got a sofa made out of books, you've gone too far, really.
Oh, well, they won't be there for long. I know they won't be there for long. But as I say, we'll do our little bit to help as well, and we'll put links on on the actual podcast site as well to how people can buy it and stuff like that. And we'll obviously do our bit to promote it on the old social media and stuff. And Vic, this has been absolutely fascinating. I apologize for all the technical snafus at the start of it, but I'm just so glad you managed to stick with it and help us out here. So, and it's really great that you stopped by the our humble little podcast. I can't ever imagine a day when I'm not going to look forward to seeing more of your work. So, because it's always fresh and fun. And anybody listening to it, if you haven't checked out Vic's work, check it out because it's awesome. And let's see if we can do this again sometime, maybe when things have eased off a bit and next time the post office closes and you've got a spare hour. But I will put all the links to Vic's work on how to order a new book and how to book him for work on our website as well. Meantime, Vic, stay safe, keep busy. Thanks again. And we'll see you soon. All the best.
Nice one. Take it easy, Keith.
You too.
Cheers, mate.
I told you it was good. If you haven't checked out Vic's work, please do, and help his book become a bestseller by getting your coffee table a copy to impress your guests. It'll make you look a lot more trendy than that bottle of gin you're thinking of buying. All the details are in the show notes on the website at www.thefuelpodcast.com. Should we do this again soon? I hope so. You've been really cracking at supporting our show, and I'd personally like to thank you. Don't forget, if you're interested in exploring great new business opportunities in the marketing area, just send me an email and we can organise a free trial of the Advertist for you. Stay tuned for more adventures in podcasting brought to you by The Fuel, the new business podcast, in association with The Advertist, the new business development platform for the new business curious. And really, shouldn't that include you?